Tonight we have a 40-minute speaker, Jack C. from Newport.
Good evening. I'm Jack and I'm an alcoholic. I'm talking too close, the microphones are hollering, somebody say something because I won't know it. I'm not a big-time speaker. Can you hear me? Not a big-time speaker. I never know what's going to come out of my mouth, you know, and I tell a story. I was 3 months sober, and I had a sponsor. He says, you can never refuse an AA request, no matter what it is, unless you have this really legitimate, bona fide reason. So I'm at a morning meeting that I would go to, and these guys are sitting there, and they're looking for volunteers to go on a panel to Garden Grove. And I said, okay, I'm not doing anything, I'll go. And so the panel started at 6 o'clock at night, and they said, do you want to go with us? We'll drive. And I go, thought to myself, no, I'll take my own car. There's no way you're trapping me in a car with you AA guys to do this panel, but I can't refuse this request. So I all day long, I'm thinking about what I'm going to say, and just driving myself crazy thinking about what I'm going to say. So on the way down there, I called my wife at the time, and I said, she goes, what are you doing? I go, thinking about what I'm going to say. She says, why don't you just tell them what an asshole you are? Oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's a good idea. To get to the story, so we get to this recovery house where we're supposed to be doing this panel. There's four AA guys. And we walk in the recovery house, and there's one guy in the house, and he's drunk. So I wasted my entire day worrying about what I was going to say and never got to say anything at all. So from that day on, I just quit worrying about what I was saying. What's coming out of my mouth is coming out of it. You know, that's kind of the way it's going to go. I was sitting here in front, and I see this Easy Does It sticker, and it's glaring, it's glittering, and it's everything else. And I was thinking to myself, oh, man, I remember those stickers. I'm in the produce business, so I work on 7th and Central Avenue, and I get up at midnight, and I drive to work every night from first Redondo Beach, Camino, Huntington Beach, and then finally Newport Beach. And I drive down there, and I get to work, and I do a big old gagger line, and we start drinking on the market about 4 o'clock in the morning. And we sell vegetables, fruits and vegetables. I mean, you know, that was our game. We were just hustling. It's like, kind of like a car salesman, you know. You're selling it no matter what it is. If it's rotten, we don't care, we're selling it. It's got to go today. And every day coming home, about 11:30, 12 o'clock, I'd be driving that freeway. And occasionally I'd see one of these Easy Does It stickers, and I'd just be going to stuff, oh, yeah, Easy Does It, Easy Does This. I'm all just trying to get home, stressed out, drunk, loaded, you know. And this went on for a lot of years, trying to sell these vegetables. And the period that, or the Jesus stickers used to always get me on the backs of the cars. And then I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing I look up on the Newport Alano Club over there at 32nd Street is this Easy Does It, One Day at a Time, all these slogans. And I thought, oh, wow, Easy Does It. And even today, sometimes it's not that easy to do it, you know, but I try and slow down a little bit. So anyway, I don't even know where to start with you guys. I was thinking about it. Cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient, you know, this disease of alcoholism. And that's kind of what it's been for me. It was very cunning, you know. And to me, I was thinking cunning is something that's sneaky, tricky, kind of lures you in, takes you out, goes around, you know. And that's alcoholism, because I drank and did drugs for a long time, and I thought I was getting by with it. I thought it was working for a long, long time, even though it wasn't working even then. It didn't work then. I was coming home. I was 16 years old, and I was coming home from a summer vacation. I lived in Covina at the time, and I was playing baseball, and I was going to be this big baseball star, and I was a football player, and I was just this clean-cut, shaved athlete, and we had a pickup truck full of beer on 52nd Street in Newport Beach with 30 guys standing there for a week, and all we do was drink and fight for a week. We fought with everybody. In those days, there wasn't a lot of police, there wasn't cell phones, there wasn't shit to get caught. So you could drink and fight and do whatever you wanted to do. And I'm driving home down Brea Canyon Road. At the time, there wasn't a 55 freeway, there wasn't a 57 freeway in Diamond Bar, and I fall out of this Volkswagen bus in my swimming trunks, and a guy grabs my arm, and he's pulling me along the highway, and I get these third-degree burns all over my body. And they take me to the hospital, and the guy says, we can keep you in hope here overnight, or you can go home, and we'll give you some stuff and clean it up in the bathtub. So So I went home. I made the option. I was still drunk. I went home and left my brother, who was on crutches from wrecking his motorcycle, drunk about two months before, hit a tree up in Camino Hills. So he was laughing because now he got to scrub these things out of me. But that's when I was 16. See, and I don't think, well, that was a problem. That was just a bad happening. But I didn't get to play baseball that season. I didn't, you know, I missed the summer. I missed everything. And my big goal, I'm going to skip around. My big goal was always, guys, going to be this professional baseball player. All through school, when I was little, the whole deal. And I had a scholarship to USC, UCLA to play baseball out of high school. And I kind of started with that. Was the beginning of breaking that scholarship up. I wound up playing second baseman for the Terminal Island Falcons. If anybody, you guys know where that is, it's a federal prison down here in Wilmington, Terminal Island. And that's why I wound up. That was the end of my career. I was a second baseman for the Terminal Island Falcons in the softball league, where you couldn't go outside the prison yard. So, but my drinking took me to a lot of different places, you know, but that was kind of the start of it. I was thinking about it because I always used to go to work with my dad. There wasn't any free ride with my dad. As you guys can tell, my red, white, and green tennis shoes, my Italian belt here. I'm a Sicilian, 100% Sicilian. I just got back from Italy. Last week I was over there for a month, and I've always been ingrained in this Italian deal, right? And so my dad, he was a guy when I was 13, 14, well, you're coming to work. You're not taking the summer off. You're going to work. You can unload trucks. You can do this. Well, by the time I was 15, I was on the railroad tracks swamping boxcars with his truck drivers, and they'd give us bennies and give us silver satin, the short dogs of silver satin, because they were drinking on the railroad tracks, and all we did, we were their mules, and we'd sit inside these boxcars and swamp stacks of 100-pound bags of potatoes, but we thought it was good because we'd get in shape for football season, you know, lifting all this stuff up. So I always worked. I never had a problem with a work ethic as far as that went. But I didn't even think about, well, geez, I was drinking then. You know, I was drinking in seventh grade to feel better, hot vodka out of a locker to go to a dance. But I didn't think I was drinking. That wasn't drinking. I didn't drink every day. I wasn't, you know, like, no offense to some of the younger people with the kids today. My son did it. I mean, I have a son that's trying to get sober. And they were smoking weed going to school every day. Well, I didn't do that. I maybe drank on weekends, I, you know, do something like that, and kind of functioned until I got a little bit older in my life. I got out of high school. I had this plan. Okay, I was going to go to college. I was going to get a law degree. Then I was going to become an attorney with the FBI and become like a CIA secret agent. You know, I was always pretty delusional, I guess. You know, I like that way. So I'm 18, I'm going to school, but my daddy wouldn't give me any money. He says, if you want to go to school, let you work at night. So I get up at midnight, I go to unload trucks, and I go to school. When I got out of high school, I'd gone to Europe for 3 months on $600. And I never smoked in my life. I started smoking cigarettes to look older. We started drinking and wine and cheese. And today I was watching Pamplona was on the news, the running of the bulls in San Fermin. Well, I was one of those guys that went to San Fermin and got drunk the whole night, and they go, how could you run with them? I go, when you wake up, you're drunk. They run early in the morning. They never run them in the afternoon. Everybody's sober by then. You know, they start drinking again. You know, so I was involved in that, and I came back, and by the time I was 18 years old, I started smoking weed when I was going to school. I know this is an AA meeting, and I respect the longevity of it, but I think most of the people in here tonight probably have done outside issues besides alcohol, and so I started drinking and smoking weed. We're in a 63 Chevy lowrider cruising Newport Beach from Covina, and nobody ever gets stopped in Newport Beach in a lowrider, and so I was I laugh because that jail was across from the Newport Club. It used to be the jail, and when I was 18, I was in there, and in those days marijuana was a felony. So they were charging me with this felony. I was in the Navy Reserve at the time. I just got out of submarine school up in Hunters Point, San Francisco. And I was trying. I had a lot going on even then, right? And here I am. And so now I'm crying my eyes out, and I'm never going to get loaded again, and I'm never going to do this. No, please, God, don't want to get this felony. Oh, God, I'm going to straighten up. I'm going to do all this. And all that praying, you know, is that. That same prayer that I did most of my life was, please, God, just get me out of this, you know. And I never, I learned how to pray in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a God of my own understanding in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I did this little deal, and I went up there, and I got out of this thing. I wound up with an honorable discharge. I mean, out of the military. I mean, it was just, I'm skipping around. I'm trying to go fast because I really want to talk about sobriety instead of my story, because, I mean, I got sober when I was 40 years old. So I had a real good 21, 22 years of creating a lot of wreckage and chaos in my life and my folks' life and just anybody that was around me. I get out of there, I'm all good, I get back, I'm doing pretty well, and then I decide I'm gonna start just smoking a little bit again and drinking a little more than I did, and I was working every day. I made a bunch of money, and the guy was gonna pay me over 3 years, so it gave me an income so that I didn't have to really work. And about that time, the movie Easy Rider came out. And so I turned right around 3 days later, and I always loved motorcycles. I had dirt bikes since I was a kid. You could get them when you're 15 and a half and ride a motorcycle. I had a 250 Yamaha Scrambler, and then I bought a Sportster, and then I got the 74s, and I had a Panhead, I had a Knucklehead. So I got in these motorcycles, and I was the freest guy alive, but I also got into other drugs, chemicals, and things where I had no place to be in. So I spent a few years doing that. I did some geographics. You know, when they read in chapter 3 of all the ways we tried, you know, to do this. Well, I did every one of those that they read. More physical exercise, switching from scotch to brandy. And then the guy, when I finally got sober, they talked about, well, this is a geographic. Well, I was doing geographics my whole life. I had taken off. I was in some trouble with some guys that I was running around with. I should have realized it. I mean, they were getting out of Soledad, San Quentin. They had been locked up for years, and I was running with these guys up in West Covina. One of my best friends, they had just disbanded the Lake Oak chapter, the Hell's Angels, which is up in Azusa Ballpark area at the time. And so I was just running around with these guys, not with any clubs or anything, riding motorcycles, just doing the deal, being free, thinking I was free. I wound up having to leave town after a bar fight and went to Mexico just to get some heat off and take a vacation and try and get rid of a real bad drug habit that I had. And I got down in Mexico and I started living on the beach, and it was wonderful. And I was smoking a little weed, learned to speak Spanish in my shorts, talking to all the girls. I was the man. One more time, I was the man. I was in heaven, you know. And I got so that everybody came to me. I started just little entrepreneurship in the trailer park with the pot with the local people, selling some unstamped mezcal from up in the mountains. I started going to the mountains. I met the Mexicans and started getting up in the mountains. And I can go round and round with that, but I wound up getting arrested and convicted in Mexico for, I don't know, I had a life sentence in a Mexican prison. I did 1 year when I was 22 in a federal prison in Mexico. You know, I got released from there for being crazy. That's the only way you could get out of it. It cost me a lot of money, and after this year, they let me out for being crazy. And part of this, and why I'm telling you, is part of this insanity of it was, I was crazy. I was truly crazy. And part of the probation, or the parole, to come back to the United States, was I had to spend 1 month in a mental hospital of their picking. They could pick it. And the lawyer on the airplane would say, oh, no, you're smart like a fox. You're smart like a fox. I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I'm smart like a fox. I mean, here I am, you know, coming home. I'm all beat. I spent 6 months of that I spent in solitary confinement in a one-room dirt cell. And the only reason I'm going to tell you this is because it was on a fourth step of mine. And I thought I would never tell anybody this. And I'll tell this whole group tonight. You know, I spent 6 months in a mud cell with no bathroom, no nothing, by myself that you couldn't even stretch out in. And I was drinking my own pee and to stay alive, and they let me out periodically with the other group prisoners. But I was I'd fight. I loved to fight, and I'd get in fights, and they put me back in. I'd hit the guards, and they put me back in. And so I spent 6 months in this situation, and so when I get to this mental hospital, I finally get home, and I get to this mental hospital. I'm going to go check in, and all I got to do is behave. See, but I don't know how to behave. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, and now I'm crazy to boot. You know, and I don't know how to behave, so I get to the mental hospital. I immediately start getting trouble in there. And it was a nice place. I mean, you had females in it, and you had your own room, and it was great, and it was wonderful. And all I had to do was sit there. But I was the type of guy that they frisked you coming in, and I had found four bullets to my gun left. They had taken all this stuff out of my room and my parents' house. And I had found these four bullets, and I tried to take the four bullets with me, thinking I might get a gun. You know, I mean, that's how I thought. My perception was that bad. And it's still bad today. Why I'm telling you this, it's still bad today. My perception is still off today. It's still skewed how I think when I get up in the morning. So I get to this hospital, and so I immediately get thrown down, shot with Thorazine again for fighting with these two bouncer guys that were in there, whatever they are. And so I decide, okay, well, I'll show them that I'm only here because I have to be here, so I'm going to escape. So I make this little plan. After about a week and a half, I sneak, get out of the place, but I'm just proving a point. See, I'm just going to prove this point. So I walk across the street, I get a paper, and I'm sitting in the park. And they're screaming and hollering, people are looking all over, and I'm reading the paper sitting in the park. Because I can't leave because I can't get off this thing, off this parole thing to get stay here and not go to jail again. So they get me. Well, instead of me only doing 2 more weeks, they decide, you probably are pretty in bad shape. We're going to put you up in Pasadena, that Metropolitan State Hospital. It used to be across from Santa Anita Racetrack up there. So now it takes me 3 months to get out of there because I'm truly whacked, truly crazy. I mean, I don't know if anybody here has ever suffered from that mental illness to that extreme or whatever, but it's not really much different than drinking every day when you get up, saying you're going to quit, and a month later you start drinking again. I mean, there's not really much difference. You know, the second step talks about came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. But in the 12 and 12 in the big book, there's only one little paragraph, and it says, who in fact is willing to admit that they are mentally ill? Well, I do that with all these young guys, and I know, and they talk about it, and they look at me, what was I really not? Look what you're doing. That's mental illness. That's not soundness of mind when we're drinking like that or we're drugging like that and we're destroying everything in our lives and we can't stop, but we continue to do it. You know, and that was why I'm telling this story about this mental hospital and stuff. And I got out of there and I finally kind of got my bearings after about 6 months to a year. I got off the Thorazine, I got whatever. Actually, I'm going to tell you the truth how I got off it. Some friend of mine took me, the same guy that I was telling you about, had the motorcycle. He's my best friend in life. He took me over to another friend of mine's house. I got a bunch of drugs and a bunch of booze and a girl. And I kind of just, I couldn't even walk. I mean, I was like a zombie. And I started drinking again. I kind of snapped out of it for a while. But what that did for me is, this guy and myself, we got on another train and we hitchhiked up through Canada, went to Afghanistan in 1971. I think it was 1971. He passed away this past few years ago, but in 1971, and there was nothing in Afghanistan at the time, absolutely nothing. We hitchhiked our way through and we had a plan. One more time, I had a plan. We're going to make some easy money and we're going to come back here and it wasn't going to be a problem. Well, I have pictures that I was going to be there for a month and I spent 6 months in Kandahar, Afghanistan, just getting wasted. And the plan never came through. He almost died from needed dysentery. We brought him home, came back here, and, you know, one more time, my good plans. And this went on forever with me. Like I said, my final demise was, I guess, I'd gotten married to my dad's partner's daughter. Because I figured, okay, they sent me up to Oregon, Washington, Idaho. I was buying potatoes from them, kicked me out of the loop, stay out of trouble. And I'd pretty much stayed out of trouble. And so I'd gotten married to my dad's partner's daughter. But I'd also started drinking a lot again. And so the marriage wasn't lasting. It lasted about 5 months. And my plan, my best plan, was I was going to take over my dad's company because now I had his partner's daughter and him. So I would be the sole apparent heir to this big company that he had. What they wound up doing was not only did I get the divorce, they kicked me out of the company. so I moved down to the South Bay, and the result of living in the South Bay and hanging out in Redondo, Hermosa, Manhattan in 1978-79, was that stay in Terminal Island Federal Prison that I was talking about when I was playing second base. And after I got out of there, I said, okay, here's the deal. I'm never going to sell drugs. I'm never going to do anything illegal again. I had a 5-year parole, and nothing was ever going to happen to me like that again. I wasn't going to do that. I was working 2 jobs. I was back on track, but I never sold any drugs. I never did any of that, but I never stopped taking them. That was my problem. I never quit using them. I mean, I'd drive to the produce market again, come back home again. I built up. I had a capacity to build something up, but I would always lose it. You know, and when I got sober, they told me to read different books and stuff, and I didn't have a fear of success, as failure. I had it because I always failed. I had a fear of success. For some reason, I had this low self-worth and this giant ego that I didn't know how to balance them. You know, my ego is always saying, this is right, this is right. And my self-esteem is going, this isn't good, this isn't good. I was the type of drinker that after I moved to Newport Beach, I would drink on the market. I could drink on 7th and Central Avenue and the Mexican bars, 5th and Stanton, all in that area. And I could come home, shower, change my clothes, and go down and drink at the Ritz with all the people in the high... I mean, that's... I'm Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, when you're drinking. You go from here drinking to here drinking and thinking you belong everywhere you're at. But really, in your heart, you belong nowhere. That emptiness and that hole they talk about is what you're searching for, something that's going to make you happy. It just didn't work anymore. In 1985, I was married now, and I had a daughter, and my ex-wife. I say ex-wife today because 7-8 years ago she started using drugs again and couldn't stop, and we wound up getting a divorce. And you know, it's the way it was. My kids were all grown, but my ex-wife at the time, she was going into a hospital program over at Long Beach Memorial Hospital. They had one of the first CD units down there. Well, I was going to go do the family week, but that weekend I was also checking into San Bernardino County Jail for a drunk driving that I'd gotten over Thanksgiving. And so I didn't drink, and I didn't drink for 8 months after that. I went to my meetings because of my 502. But I also never got a sponsor, never did any steps. I'd go to these meetings because I had to go every Saturday. And my feeling was, you people aren't so bad, but you're just not quite for me yet. Just not quite for me. I'm a little bit different. I learned here it's terminal uniqueness. And it was going to kill me if I didn't stop what I was doing. But it took me a long time to learn this lesson. If you're young in here, I hope you don't have to go through that same years of wasting your youth. Just wasted. I look back on it. I don't regret it. I can regret it. It's bullshit. I regret throwing away 20 years of my fucking life. I do regret it. You know? And it really is. I do. But my point is you don't have to do this, but you have to get reasonably stupid and willing. I mean, that's why I say this program isn't... I mean, I overthought this program. I overthought you. I was too busy being somebody important when I was really nobody to anybody but myself, because that's how I acted. I was nobody to my 3 children. I was nobody to my business partners. I was nobody to nobody. You know, you talk about we're losers. Well, hell, I don't know if I was a loser, but I sure was empty inside, and I sure wasn't happy when I got here. So in this 85, I did this. I stuck around... I lasted 6 months, June 26th of 1989, I got sober, and I've stayed sober ever since then. I just kind of had a birthday in Italy, but I figured I'd tell you about it here because I took it. I was in Rome, and I got to go to a meeting in Rome where I met a lot of people because I've been going back to Italy the last 5-6 years. I wanted to learn to speak Italian. You know, let me get to that. I'm going to be back up here. So anyway, so I get sober in 1989, June 26th, and I go into a hospital program for 21 days. And I've been in Las Vegas drinking. My dad, who was 70 years old, had fallen down and broke his hip, and he went into alcoholic seizures 3 weeks prior to that. And I told him, I said, hey, Pop, when I was seeing him, I said, you know, I'll go to those meetings with you when you get out. We'll be okay. Well, it was his graduation, birthday, and it was also my brother's lunch. And I went to a luncheon party and sent my wife to his party, and I went to Las Vegas and stayed drunk for 4 days. And when I came back, I woke up in the morning and I said, holy shit, God, I'm going crazy again. Please don't let me go crazy. Anything but do not let me go crazy again, because I knew how hard it was to come back from being crazy. It was almost impossible. So I called the cab and I went over to this Hogue Hospital and I told the cab driver, he goes, it'll be $40. And I said, hey, pal, I got one chip left. He goes, yeah, but what am I going to do with the chip? I go, that's your fucking problem. I'm going in here to check into the hospital. And I went and I checked into that Hogue Hospital. I stayed there the 21 days. And my dad said, he says, what are you doing here? I don't get out till tomorrow. I get out. Why are you visiting me? I go, no, Dad, I'm checking in. And he stayed sober till he was 77 years old. And I got a relationship with my father in Alcoholics Anonymous that I never had before in my life. Because I always looked at my father as someone who, he was hardworking, he was tough, he had gnarled knuckles, big nose, big beak, and he worked his ass off day and night, and he wasn't a man of a lot of words. You know, that's how we grew up. And once we got sober together, we started having conversations, and I quit looking at him. All the people that I admired, that I thought were better than my own father, I started realizing that, you know what, I had the best dad in the whole world. I didn't even know it. And I didn't, I started spending time with him. I started doing a lot of stuff with him. He passed away when he was 7 years sober. And I got to put my chip on his grave. And I did the eulogy at his funeral, which my brother is a year and a half older with me, but he was drinking and he couldn't do it. He says, I can't do this. I said, well, I'll get through it. I'll do it. You know, when I got sober, I grabbed a sponsor that he had been in bed 13 at Charlie Street. And he was an old Vietnam vet, and he was from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he had what I wanted. You know, he just had what I wanted. He told the truth. He didn't, you know, and he didn't have a lot of money. He didn't have anything else. I mean, when I got sober, I had a business, a wife, 3 kids, big house in Newport Beach, lots of cars, everything, and I was the most miserable person alive. None of that made me happy. So when, you know, and people today tell me, oh, yeah, well, if I had your money, I'd be happy too. Well, the money didn't make me happy. You don't understand. You weren't here when I got here. I was not happy. You know? And I will, I'm going to go and I'm going to say this. You know, when they told me that the depth, if you ask a lot of people in a meeting and you say to them, well, what are the 12 steps? What are they? You know, and you'll get different opinions. Like, how do you do a 4-step? You'll get different opinions. But I know in the 12 and 12 that it says that the steps are a group of principles that are spiritual in their nature, that practices a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink, and render the sufferer usefully whole. Happily and usefully whole. I want to throw in happily because that was my point. It gave me some peace and some happiness that I never had before. Oh yeah, I'd laugh, I'd giggle, I'd think it was funny. Most of the time I was laughing at your errors, your mistakes, your something, but I never truly laughed. I never cried till I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And after a few years in AA, I'd watch a movie. I'd be like, Jesus, man, I'm sobbing like a baby. You're not supposed to be sobbing. To this day, I go watch a movie in the show with my girlfriend, who's a normal gal, and she'll look over at me, and I got tears going on. She's like, what the fuck is wrong with you, Jeff? Just, you know, but I know the difference between my glass being half full and being half empty today, you know, and I didn't know what that was until I got enough gratitude to realize that every day is a new day for me. You know, my grand sponsor, he took 44 years the other night at our meeting, and he's not a man of a lot of words, and he said, as he was closing, he said, if I get another 4.5 hours today, I'll have another day tomorrow. And that's pretty much what Alcoholics Anonymous is for me. I've been living this 24-hour-a-day program, one day at a time. My original sponsor told me, somebody'd ask you how much time you'd have, and he'd go, what time did you get up this morning? Because we got today. That's all we got today. And he drilled that into my head. It's today. When you wake up in the morning, it's a new day. I'd call him with a problem. He goes, go do something for another alcoholic and call me back and tell me about your problem. And when I didn't call him back, I'd call him the next morning. He goes, what happened to that problem? I go, never mind. Forget it, it went away. It wasn't that big of a problem. He was the type of guy that my ex-wife was getting loaded, my kids are at preschool, and I got a gun and I'm going to kill, I know where she's at and I'm going to kill these people where he's at. I mean, it took me, I'm not trying to sound like a badass, but it took me a good 9 years to take the gun out of my car because I was going to LA and I was justified having it where I was working, you know, on this marketplace. But the fact was I was just, I don't know, I needed this gun. Why? I don't know. I had a gun. 3 years I had a gun. So, but it took me this time, and he's the type of guy that says, okay, here's what you're going to do before you go kill these people. You go to Charlie Street, you wait, you work with these guys at Charlie Street for an hour, you go pick your kids up from school, so you don't leave them at school, then you bring them home, then you go kill these guys. So, that's what I'm going to do. And by the time I go to Charlie Street, I spend an hour with these drunks and these wet guys, you know, I'd get home and go, I'm too tired to kill these guys. I'm even I'll kill them tomorrow if she don't come home. And that was my that insanity of my perception and my thinking. You know, I was telling Jack, he loves this story. I had these old Gucci shoes that I bought in Capri about 7, 8, 9 years ago, and you couldn't buy them in the United States. You could not buy these shoes, and they were the coolest white sneaker tennis shoes alive. And I wore these shoes till the soles wore out. There was holes in the bottom. There was no tanning on top. And I came home. I came home from Italy. Like I was showing you guys my red, white, and green shoes. And I got my new cool shoes now. So I was going to throw these shoes away because I didn't have any room in my closet. And I said, no, man, I got to wear these shoes one more time. And so I wore them to that meeting that night. When I got back and took my birthday, and I was telling the story that these shoes still hurt my feet, the soles are bad, they got holes in them, but I was going to wear them one more time, just like I was going to drink one more time. And I hadn't worn these shoes in a year, they'd just been sitting in the closet, but I was going to try it one more time with these shoes. Well, I got home and I threw those shoes away, you know, and in 1989, in June 26th, I got rid of that alcohol, and I haven't had a drink since. I haven't had any mind-altering chemicals in my system, same scenario, same thinking for me. You know, it's not the first drink that you hear all the cliches, you've heard it all. And there's guys in here that have been sober a lot longer than me. This meeting's been here forever, you know, which is great. You know, we had a Roxbury group up in Beverly Hills, you know, LA, that our meeting I joined. But I say, okay, so here's how my sobriety starts. The guy says, my sponsor says, okay, you need to go to Men's Stags. Well, why do I need to go to Men's Stags? Because you need to go to Men's Stags. You don't need to be looking. You can go to some mixed meetings, but you're 40, you're married, you're not having the best relationship with your ex-wife, with your wife at the time. So rather than look at the girls, you can go to mixed meetings, but you go to a meeting a day for 90 days. You don't miss a meeting. You don't get to go to 2-in-1 day and count it as 86 and 87. You go to one every day or don't count. You start over. I said, okay. So he says, you go to Charlie Street every Saturday morning, the Men's Stag at Charlie Street. For humility, because you need some. And he says, and then you go to this heliotrope meeting up in Corona del Mar for solution. He says, you'll get solution from those men in that room. And some of you guys have been around a long time. You'll know there was a guy around here, Bill Marcus. That was his home group. Russ Pruitt. These are a lot of guys from Upper Orange County that have died and passed away. Lindy Lindemann. All these guys are going to that meeting. And so I went to that meeting. And like I said, I was 40 years old, and these guys are laughing at me because they're young, and they run in this big pack of guys, these young kids that are all sober now. When I say they're kids, they're 23, 24, 25. They're graduating college. They're doing well. They got jobs. They're not getting low. They're sober. They're sponsoring guys. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what I love to see. You know, my son's got a week sober. He's been trying for a year, year and a half. Jails, mental institutions, rehabs, different stuff. But he's coming along. I have hope for him. There's hope, you know. He's not drinking a day, and that's hope for me. I was smart. I figured, well, shit, none of these new guys are going to mess with me because there's nothing worse than a 25-year-old kid coming up to me telling me, hey, man, if you do this and you do that, you're going to be okay when I was new. So I grabbed these old guys. I go, hey, can I hang out with you guys? And they go, sure, come on, kid. And they took me to lunch, and I hung out with the old guys, and nobody messed with me because I was old anyway, and they thought I was old, and they didn't know how much time I had once I was done with the 30 days. Nobody asked, nobody cared. But what it did for me, they had these routines, and they went to meetings, and they continuously went to meetings. That saying of, when do you get to quit going to meetings? You get to quit going to meetings when you want to go to meetings, and you go to meetings when you don't want to go to meetings. because I think the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, barring no, this is just my opinion. I mean, God keeps me sober every day. I know that. You know, I thank God every day for my sobriety. I ask Him in the morning. You know, I do a third step prayer in the morning, seventh step prayer at night to this day every night, morning and night. And God keeps me sober. But the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I found in here, if you guys are new coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, there are some, I mean, you can't get a better show on earth for a buck and a half than you get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we have more characters in Alcoholics Anonymous, more colorful personalities, you name it. I mean, in here, in I'd say 70-80% of my good friends today are all sober men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and women. You know, and that's just where my life has changed. I still kept, or in early sobriety, I kept every one of my Italian friends. I went to every drinking event. I have four of them now that are in Alcoholics Anonymous with me, because I just go and I pour more. What do you mean you had enough? Have some more. They got so drunk that they just surrendered and came into this group. But, you know, but they're sober long term. 122 years, 120 years, you know, 15, and they go down the road. And we, you know, we find one of our Italian goombas occasionally. I still go on these golf things. I'm going on one next week. And I play these guys. I'm going to Reno, and we plan a golf tournament in Reno. And my friends own a bunch of casinos in Reno, and one of them sober, Italian guys. Yeah, we have a meeting. There's 12 of us now that go to this meeting out of a 50-person golf tournament. We have an AA meeting every morning before we tee off and play golf, which is pretty cool. You know, it's pretty cool. And I really like these. The fellowship, like I said, the fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you have to stay here long enough. You have to be willing enough to feel the pain to stay here, to feel different, to feel not wanted, to feel lonely, to feel all these things. You have to, basically, I'm antisocial. I mean, I would rather sit home by myself, watch TV, and not talk to anybody. That's just my personality. That's the way it is. But I forced myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was complaining. I says, oh, yeah, sure, all these guys, yeah, they want to shake hands with the girls. They want to introduce themselves. But none of them want to talk to me. I thought, what the fuck is this? You know? Excuse my language. I try not to swear tonight. Usually I'm the greatest swearer. You can't sell fruits and vegetables without swearing. That's what I mean. So he says, well, how about if you try putting your hand out to the men? Why don't you try being a greeter, try being a chair setup guy, try doing all these commitments when you first get here, and maybe if you reach your hand out to the men, they'll reach their hand out back. Now, all of us go to a Wednesday night stag, all these guys sitting right here in this row, we go to a Wednesday night stag, and you were saying Jim W.'s coming down, and he started that meeting, and he closed that meeting every week, and you know, we're part of that posse from that stag on Wednesday night, besides our Tuesday night stag a lot of us go to, and you realize that the commonality and the bond that I formed in Alcoholics Anonymous, I shouldn't say that you can form, that I formed in Alcoholics Anonymous is unique to any bond I can form with anybody that's not an alcoholic. They just don't understand. They just can't understand that insane thinking. Now, I noticed last night they just came out with a TV show called Perception. Well, fuck, we've been talking about perception in Alcoholics Anonymous since I got here. You know, that our perception's messed up, right? You know, I mean, that's the truth. Well, I perceive this is the worst thing that happens to me. It turns out to be the best thing that happens to me. I perceive that my day's over today because somebody rejected a load of honeydews on me, right? Who gives a shit? I pack like 50,000 honeydews a day. What's 1,000 honeydews, right? And it turns around that the next morning, the market's higher anyway, and I sold that same bad load that I thought I was going to throw away for more money, right? I perceive that I'm going to make all this money off of this crop, and the market goes down, I lose all my money. So it doesn't matter. You know, and it's not about the money. I perceive that the guy sitting back here, let me pick one. That's because somebody looks like he's got a bad attitude. Okay, no. All right, so I perceive that the guy over here, this guy's got to be a moron, and he's a doctor. I perceive this guy knows shit about this, and he can put together cars better than anybody you've ever seen in your life. So we all have our skill sets in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, but my perception of who you are by how you look is always skewed. And it's always been that way my whole life. Always. always, always. When Kathleen called me up, she called me and I said, well, I can't come because I'm going to Italy. I can't come because I've been sick. I said, but I can come July 7th. What's the day today? I don't know. Whatever the day is today. I said, I can come. So I came back and I never asked her who gave him my name. I never asked him what the meeting was. I brought a sport coat because I've been to some of these Pacific Group speaker meetings and stuff where I wear your coat. I ain't got no tie, but I'll wear a coat. It's that simple for me. So when I came in, I said to Kathleen, I said, by the way, who gave you my name? Right? I didn't ask her what the meeting was like or anything else. And she goes, oh, it was Jim Hogan. I thought, Jim Hogan, I should have known. Frickin' Jim Hogan, because we got sober together. And him and his wife used to beat me up when I was new, mercilessly. We'd go to dinner after a meeting on Friday nights. We started a speaker meeting, and we all, but I hung with that. And that was a regimented AA group of people who want to carry the message that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And it can work for everybody in this room, whether you're new, whether you're relatively new, whether you're old, you're older, you know, and there are no coincidences in God's world. My young pal here speaks Swedish. He's always telling me, oh yeah, I speak Swedish. I'm a Swedish guy. I came born in Sweden. I live in Dallas. He's a cowboy from Dallas, but he claims he's Swedish. So I run into this man sitting out here on this bench at the half, and I go, with a break, and I'm talking to him, and I'm going, hey, detect an accent. You Swedish? He goes, I'm Swedish. I go, oh, man, wait till I tell this guy. I got a guy that can speak Swedish too. And Jack's laughing. He's getting, oh, look at him speaking Swedish. You know, we're all excited. Look at how excited we are about him speaking Swedish now. Shit. And that's my whole night. Before, I would have had to go wind up in jail, wreck my car, lose something, and spend another month to get excited. But I'm excited about the kid speaking Swedish. You got to speak Swedish. You know, and I'm sure you're excited you got to speak Swedish. There's another Sweden over there. You know, but that's kind of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you can't get a laugh in here, you know, it's your fault. It's your fault if you can't get a laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have a big thing in my office that says the greatest show on earth. It was Barton Bailey's old poster. And I used to, because to me, what I do, I still love doing it. It was the greatest show on earth. We'd joke each other, we'd poke each other, we'd make fun of each other. When I came back to work from Italy, my partner, I came in and I got red pants on, these tennis shoes, this white belt I picked up, a black polo, a white hat. And he goes, hey, Bruno Mars, you're back. I didn't call these guys for a month. I never called work once. Screw the money, I wanted a vacation, never called work. So the day progressed, hey, Bruno Mars. The whole day was just, yep, this Bruno Mars shit. So as I was leaving, I said, guess what? He goes, what? I go, I got a dentist appointment tomorrow, but when I come back Wednesday, I'm going to put on my regular clothes, I'm going to kick the shit out of you as soon as I see you with a Bruno Mars all day long. You know, and he's a good friend of mine. He's one of my business partners. But that's, so it's the greatest show on earth. And the only other show that I've seen greater than that is Alcoholics Anonymous in these rooms. With the people in here and the laughter that we get, and we can tease and we can poke. So if somebody's poking at you and they're laughing at you and you're new, they're laughing with you. They're not laughing at you. I know I'm not laughing at you. But if you can't find some humor in yourself and you can't reach down deep enough to become a human being, you're not going to get sober. And you're going to have to smash that ego and raise your self-esteem. Smash that ego and raise your self-esteem. And that's what these steps are designed to do, is beat down that ego and raise that self-esteem to here. In the book, it talks about getting down to right size. Well, I didn't know what right size was, so I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what character defects were. I was just a defect in a body walking around for 40 frickin' years, you know, and didn't even know what they were. Never knew what they were, you know. And I know what right size is today, that I know better than, or I know less than you, and I don't have to be. I can just be part of this herd. Or I can be that one sheep that thinks he's bitchinger than the rest, and he's out there telling the dogs that they're crazy, and he can wander around, and when they come and they eat him, and the dogs go, see, I told you, other sheep, this is what happens. You go outside this perimeter. I mean, you got a group of people, you got the white picket fence they talk about. It's in here in Alcoholics Anonymous if you want it. If you want to stay here, you want to change your life, you want a life beyond your wildest dreams like you hear about, I found it here, and I think you can all find it here too. I'm going to close with I'm a firm believer in what it says in chapter 5, that rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Right? Not 5%, 10%, 20%. Rarely have we seen a person fail to get sober, to get this life, that has thoroughly followed this path. And I do this today, whether I like to, I don't like to. I do it. I do Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for Kathleen asking me to come and see you guys.